37.
Direct the Portland Bureau of Transportation to adopt administrative rules for the safe accommodation of pedestrians and bicyclists in and around work zones.
Commissioner Novick.
Colleagues, this item addresses the very issue that Ms. Rose just brought up. One of the side effects of the rapid pace of development we've seen recently is that sometimes people biking and walking have been left with closed sidewalks or bike lanes without adequate accommodation. And due to the fact that people have raised concerns about this issue and the fact that this fits in well with our Vision Zero policy, KeyBot is developing administrative rules to ensure people walking and biking are kept safe around work zones. Under the new guidelines, temporary detours that are out of direction or across the street for people walking, biking, and using mobility devices can be considered only after exhausting other options. In other words, safe passage for vulnerable users will be the default, even if it requires temporarily closing a motor vehicle lane or removing parking temporarily. PBOT expects to fully incorporate the official guidelines to the building permit process for new projects by the 2017 construction season. This is Vision Zero in action. This is a response to concerns raised by many citizens. It's one of the ways our Vision Zero policy is translated into safety on the street. And now I'm pleased to turn it over for further elaboration to Leah Treat and Faith Weingart.
Great. Thank you, Commissioner, and the rest of the council. I'm really excited to be here today to talk about this, and so glad that we have got these administrative rules ready to go for your review and approval. This is the culmination of about 3 years of work on this, and it's really been supported. So thank you to Oregon Walks, BTA, and a lot of advocacy organizations that have helped us shape these policies. You know, as we are looking at unprecedented growth in the city and in development, we have repeatedly heard that pedestrians especially and then cyclists are being negatively impacted. So when sidewalks get closed, just as Ms. Camilla Rose Waters told you, people are diverted across traffic. There's not safe passage for them. And this is really a reflection of understanding that we have all different types of users accessing our transportation network. It's not just vehicles. We have pedestrians. We have cyclists. We have lots of people trying to get around in different ways. So we are trying to have safe passage for everyone in the city. And this is also not only a Vision Zero policy, but it's also supported by our comp plan and our hierarchy of how we are looking at the traveling public, that we want to prioritize the safety of pedestrians and cyclists along with automotive traffic. So I'm going to turn it over to Faith to walk through a PowerPoint that's got more details, and we can answer any questions you have about the policy. Thank you.
Thanks. Faith Weingarten, I'm the temporary street use permitting manager. And so the resolution that we're putting before you today states that when work is being performed in the right-of-way which impacts a sidewalk or a bike route, providing an adjacent walkway or a bike path is the default position. So closures are deemed a last resort in the absence of other practicable routing or accommodation options. The problems that we wanted to solve are that closures are leaving people walking and biking with less than ideal conditions to navigate through and around, and detours that involve crossing streets or going out of direction, making the more attractive option the unsafe choice. So Vision Zero recognizes that the safe choice should also be convenient. A problem is that sidewalk closures with detours that are inconvenient, then people walking may choose a more dangerous route. Detours for people walking, biking, and using mobility devices are undesirable because they result in lower compliance. By forcing people to deviate their path, detours increase the likelihood that people will travel in a way that increases the risk of death or serious injury.
Can we keep this slide for a second? Because you've said this is the problem, so we're getting to the solution. I just want to acknowledge two things that I've observed. And this is a good picture, but the egregious examples are where the fence actually covers the entire bike lane. And I've seen that all over the city. So you're riding on a protected bike lane, it's blocked, and you've got to now get into traffic, and presumably, and in many of the streets where you have that bike lane, they are there because the streets are dangerous, and so we're encouraging people. So that's one thing. The second thing I've noticed, and it's happening all around City Hall, is that we're giving people in construction projects a permit to close a city street for the purpose of the convenience of occasionally doing deliveries.
Excuse me.
Which, by the way, at rush hour, there's never any deliveries, so you just have traffic jams. And I understand the safety issue there of wanting to occasionally allow, you know, to allow someone to go to a construction site and drop something off. But what we're effectively doing on high-frequency streets is shutting down a lane, which at rush hour makes it very difficult for people. And almost invariably, there's nothing happening during rush hour. And I just wonder whether, though, and these are not permanent closures. They have cones, and they're set up so that a truck could theoretically come. I wonder whether those could be restricted to non-rush hour hours. Just a thought. So, thank you.
We will follow up on that. I mean, we can talk further offline if you want, or I can. I mean, so there's issues of the way that we do a lot of our looking at the PM peak, the way that engineering looks at closures and permitting the right-of-ways through engineering standards that don't necessarily look at the entire day. So we could start looking at different ways to access. It would be a change in our practices and the way that we do engineering. Also, it was a conversation with a developer, so I've had a couple of conversations with people in downtown projects about taking a travel lane, and for them, in order to get safe passage without closing the entire travel lane, would then require them to hire traffic flaggers to come in and do flagging during the time that they would have deliveries done, and so that's an increased cost to them, so that's where we get pushback.
So I guess, and I'm not, you're the expert, I'm not going to debate the point, I'll defer to the way your experts look at this, but I think we have to balance that against hundreds and hundreds of cars idling in traffic unnecessarily, which does work against our climate action plan, yep. The safety issues, and just three blocks from here, there's a hotel going up, and there's a very difficult intersection with lanes blocked on both sides of that intersection. What we've done is we've created a situation that's unsafe for pedestrians, who are dodging mm-hmm. traffic. You're creating a situation that's unsafe for drivers because everyone's upset, and so they jump the light or they do other reckless things. And I get the question of convenience and cost needs to be factored, but I hope it's heavily weighted against safety and climate action, because I think they're in collision, and I'm not sure requiring someone to have a flagger is such a great inconvenience measured against the fact that they're completely screwing up the circulation for bikers and cars and pedestrians.
I appreciate it. Thank you very much. And we would that would be stronger and more stringent than what we're proposing, and I appreciate the support, so we will definitely look into it.
And we do restrict hours to non-peak hours in the downtown area, and sometimes they aren't in compliance, so that's one piece of it. So,
thank you.
So this is, as you were talking about, Commissioner Fish, you were talking about bicycle lanes, and so the next slide is just kind of demonstrating what you're saying, that the problem is that, you know, disruptions put bikes into traffic lanes without enough advance warning, or that the bike lane is compromised. So for a solution, I want to go over an example with you that is on Belmont and 21st. So the solution in this example implemented a plan which removed about 300 feet of on-street parking to maintain a travel lane and converted a travel lane to a bike and ped route, leaving the contractor the remaining right-of-way to facilitate their construction. This job site was in the middle of a block. It only had street frontage on Belmont. And so, you know, construction sites do have to have access. So this is one of the, you know, plans that we have put into action that reflect what our goals are: to maintain a travel lane, to maintain safe bike and pedestrian passage.
Can we pause on that photo for a second?
Yes.
So I like the direction you're going, but I want to quibble about a detail here.
Sure.
And that is, if I see what I think I see, which is, okay, so we're using the travel lane temporarily for mm-hmm. pedestrian and bicycle movement, right?
Right.
And there's a fenced off area where the construction staging is taking place, right?
Right.
So there are three elements. There are vertical plastic barriers, there's jersey barriers, I think the kind that you fill with water, right? Mm-hmm. And there's mm-hmm. a fence. Mm-hmm. Why don't we require that the jersey barriers be on the outside to protect the pedestrians and bicycles, mm-hmm. as well as the construction workers, instead of having the pedestrians and bicycles protected not much by a little piece of plastic? Mm-hmm. So I get it that there's a need for a jersey barrier to prevent, you know, mayhem, mm-hmm. but if we're going to do that, they're not going to spend any more money to put the jersey barriers where it would protect everybody instead of just their own workers. So I'm sure somebody just didn't think about this. But now that if those are the typical three elements, you got to have a fence to secure the construction site and a way to tell the drivers of cars you don't have this lane anymore, and we need some physical protection. Let's arrange those so that we get the maximum benefit.
And maybe even concrete barriers like you have on Jefferson between 2nd and 3rd. That does create a much safer walking environment than plastic or even the fillable water ones. So how do you choose whether you require concrete versus
Well,
other?
Our traffic engineer will make that determination, but one of the things that's a little tricky about concrete barriers is that they create their own danger if a car was to hit them, where the water-filled barriers are a safer option in some cases. So.
Safer for who? The driver or the pedestrian?
For both.
So how to explain that? How would the water-filled barriers be safer for the pedestrian?
Safer for the driver.
Yeah. I don't know exactly how to respond to that. I mean, they're a heavy obstacle, but a car could hit a concrete barrier and it can push it into the place where people are walking or biking.
If they hit the water-filled one, yeah. They just go straight into the person walking or biking.
I don't know how to respond to that, but we will certainly keep that in consideration. And, you know, our goal is certainly to make sure that pedestrians and vehicles are safe.
One other thing, not to unduly complicate this, is that I'm guessing the Fire Bureau is going to have a voice in this conversation, too. Because every time you create a barrier, you also have to balance that against, are you making it harder for an emergency vehicle to get to mm-hmm. a scene? And the picture there with the fence and the multiple barriers, you're getting to a point where if something's immovable, it may be impossible to get an emergency vehicle there. So you have to balance a number of things.
Right.
I particularly like the mayor's idea, though, of the sturdier barrier. They're still movable, but they're sturdier, protecting the bike and the walk people rather than the construction site.
Yeah, they're not going to spend any more money to put them in slightly different places. So.
Sure.
Hi, I'm Christine Leon with PBOT. So just one of the things about the concrete versus the water-filled barriers is the issue of the end treatment. So the conflict or the danger with the concrete barriers is if a head-on collision happens with a vehicle, then that driver is dead. That car is crashed. The water-filled are something that the crash impact attenuators will be more forgiving so that driver and that car is not totaled. So that's the difference. They both rely on a friction of the surface, and they're interlocked. But with the concrete barriers, you need to do this extra length of a protection area or put some more barrels in front of it, and just takes up more space. So, but I think the idea of putting the barriers between the moving vehicles and the pedestrians certainly is a wise thing. So,
okay. Thank you. Appreciate you letting us dive into the details, but they do matter.
Yeah.
Thank you.
I do think it might be, I think Commissioner Fritz is raising the point, are we protecting the driver at the expense of the pedestrians? I'd be curious if, are there instances where drivers drive through the Jersey barriers and hit a pedestrian, or do we generally see find that the Jersey barriers are protective of the pedestrians?
There's a whole science to the temporary traffic control. So, you know, the other thing is we have slower speeds that can also help make construction zones safer, more enforcement, make sure things are visible. I'm sure we have some accident information. Marguerite in our active transportation can share with us later on what the rate of crashes are through construction zones versus non-construction zones, but, you know.
I would also like to see the data on protection of the pedestrian and cyclist on the Jersey barriers versus the concrete.
Okay.
Thank you.
Okay, keep going, please.
So contractors have been responding by taking the responsibility and putting in place the requirements that we have already been working with them on. So we started working with them about a year and a half ago before this resolution has come into place, and they have done a really good job of responding and changing the way that they're looking at their work sites, making their plans upfront different in the way that they approach a work site, and that sometimes this is going to cost them more, and it's going to maybe take them longer to be able to complete their job. But we found a lot of contractors really willing to try to make sure that they're providing a safe accommodation for bikes and pedestrians. This particular location is just demonstrating, a worker at a job site making sure that the bike lane is clear of debris. So what the solution is to provide walkways adjacent to job sites wherever practicable. So not every job site and not every sidewalk is going to be accommodated. There is a lot of unsafe situations when the construction is happening that we still will need to have some sidewalks closed and that we won't be able to accommodate a pedestrian walkway just because of safety. But we are working with contractors to develop new ways to approach a work site and working with our temporary traffic control engineers. They review the plans that are submitted by the contractors when they're asking for use of the right-of-way. There are some cases where we ask a contractor to perform a traffic management study to demonstrate to us why there is not any other way than to close a sidewalk and detour. And the other part of this is that for job sites, we want to make sure that we are providing walkways that have ramps for people with disabilities. So this is consistent with the PBOT Vision Zero goals, and we're working together to ensure that people that can safely and conveniently walk and bike and use mobility devices through work zones wherever possible. Thank you.
Thank you.
Okay, questions?
Thanks.
Further questions?
Are there any, was mentioned about motion-sensitive audible signs as part of this plan?
So we have talked about that, and it's something that we're investigating. The requirement is that whatever the walkway was before, whatever the condition or the level of quality of the walkway was, that we try to replicate that. And many of these situations didn't have any kind of audible control to start with. So we certainly are looking at it, but I don't know exactly what will happen with that.
I think it is definitely something to pursue, and maybe we'll hear more in public testimony about that.
Okay.
Thank you.
Good.
Other questions? Thank you all very much. Okay, you have a sign sheet on this item, Carla?
We actually have some invited testimony first.
Okay, sorry about that. Go ahead, please.
Noel and Beth, and I think we've got one other person come up. Oh.
Come on up, please. Good morning.
Good morning. Hi, I'm Beth Raisman, and I've been an early childhood and special education teacher for the past 11 years. Currently, I teach Head Start for 3 and 4-year-olds in Southeast Portland. Professionally, I focus my learning on human behavior, particularly the role of executive function in young children. Executive function is a series of skills the brain must accomplish in order to do things like pay attention, switch focus from one thing to another, remember the rules, and use physical and emotional self-control. We can all work on our executive function skills, but young children's developing brains and limited experiences in new situations make their limited executive function skills very noticeable. Here's a story to explain why I'm talking about executive function with you now today. It's time for me to take my preschool class for a walk. My educational assistant and I walk with our 14 children across the street to visit a community garden. Even though we cross a lower traffic street, this is by far the most stressful part of our journey. It's not possible to hold each child's hand, so we adults must rely on our children's executive function skills to cross together. The children must walk forward, ignore distractions around them, keep holding hands, keep their emotions together, even if the kid behind them is stepping on their shoes, and pay attention to the adult's directions all at the same time. This is a tremendous challenge for a young child. It's stressful for me, too. It taxes my own executive function skills, as I am the eyes, ears, and brain for myself and everyone I'm with. My example represents the many daycare, preschool, and field trip groups that walk through our city each day, but it's just as relevant for parents who are walking with their kids. Because of their not yet developed executive function skills, kids are easily distracted. They walk without looking where they're going, and they're notorious for not listening carefully the first time. Plus, their physiology makes them slower walkers, and they have a smaller field of vision than adults. When we take all these factors into account, it's clear that the safest route is the one that follows the sidewalk, not the one that adds more street crossings. In my story about my class, we're crossing a quieter street. I'm sure you can imagine how this would be magnified if our street had more traffic and a construction zone detour. The barricaded pedestrian corridors I've seen in front of some recent large construction projects, and we saw pictures of them today, are good examples of ways the city can protect school groups and families. By making sidewalk closures and construction zones a last resort, the city of Portland shows caring for the safety of some of its most vulnerable residents. Thank you.
Thanks very much. Good morning.
Good morning, Mayor and Commissioners. My name is Noelle Mickleberry. I'm the Executive Director of Oregon Walks. We are the state's pedestrian advocacy organization, and I'm here today to support passing the Safe Accommodations for Bicycle and Pedestrians in Work Zones administrative rule. We've been working on this issue for a while, and I don't know how to make – oh, thank you. I have some photos. So we've been working on this issue for a couple years, and it's been brought to our attention repeatedly as a safety concern from our members. We included a passage of a resolution such as this in our 2015 Vision Zero report that we released with the Bicycle Transportation Alliance in early 2015. And we're responding to what we hear from members and people who walk and people who bike, that this is a major concern for safety. And we decided that we also wanted to understand how broad this issue was. And so we, in the last couple months, started tracking and mapping closures in the Portland area through a social media campaign that gave us a clearer idea of how prevalent this issue is. In just 2 months, we've collected over 165 unique submissions from members of the public around the barriers that they come across when they're walking and biking in the city around work zones. We saw many examples of places where parking was maintained while the sidewalk and or bike lane were closed. We saw sidewalks and bike lanes being used as storage or for signage, usually while parking was still being maintained instead of the walkway or the bikeway. We saw examples of two sides of the street blocked at once or all four corners blocked at once. This is an example where you know, ADA facilities are being put in, but while they're being put in, every single corner is entirely blocked off. So if you're using a mobility device, you'd have to go all the way to the other end of the block to get across. And oftentimes the detours will say cross here, and on the other side of the street it'll say cross to the other side of the street. We also saw a lot of examples of people being forced to cross in the middle of the block, where a detour sign would just appear, or there'd be no signage at all. These are all photos submitted from around the region from our members and supporters on social media. This is especially unsafe on places where there are a high density of people walking and on our high crash corridors. This example is on Northeast Gleason, which is in one of the top 10 most dangerous streets for pedestrians in the city. This is on the left there, Southwest Barber, where there's a 45-mile-per-hour speed limit, and on MLK Boulevard as well, where it drops people into the construction zone or having to walk around into 35-mile-per-hour traffic. One more example of Southeast Sandy and Stark, two very dangerous streets. This is also on a downhill, so if someone in a mobility device reached this, they'd have to go uphill to get back to the safest crossing. We've also started seeing examples of safe accommodations in the last month. I feel like we got more submissions in the last few weeks of positive posts, and I really thank the Bureau of Transportation for taking this very seriously, and to the contractors who are implementing it. My favorite one is on the far right. It's very accessible. It's covered. It's wide. It felt like the most safe place that I had seen. So thanks to Hoffman Construction for that one. That all got a little messed up. But basically, we encourage you to adopt this policy as a simple way to be proactive about Vision Zero and ensure that our streets are safe as growth continues. A couple final thoughts is we need to ensure that there's funding for inspection. As was mentioned before, we need to make sure that people are compliant with this new policy. So we encourage making sure that we're able to do that. And prioritize accessibility, lighting, ramps, signage. I appreciate the comments that have already been made from previous testimony and from council members around this. This needs to be the highest priority for our most vulnerable users. And also holding all city bureaus to the same standard. This, you know, applies to how the Bureau of Transportation gives out permits to private contractors. And there's a line in there about that all city bureaus should follow this. I think the city should be setting an example. It should be all city bureaus shall be following this, and I encourage you all as, you know, the leaders of these bureaus to prioritize that whenever there's work going on using the public right-of-way. So thank you so much to the Bureau of Transportation, Commissioner Novick and his team, and everyone who shared photos throughout our campaign prioritizing this issue. Thanks.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you both. Questions? Appreciate you being here.
Yeah.
Do you have some other invited testimony, Commissioner?
I think I didn't have a name, but we thought somebody from Independent Living Resources was going to be here. I don't know if somebody was able to make it or not. Apparently not.
All right. Should we turn the sign-up sheet then, please, Carl?
We have 8 people signed up.
Okay.
The first 3, please, coming up are Gwen Luda, Charles Johnson, and Mary Ng.
Okay. Come on up, please. Good morning.
Good morning.
I think you're first.
Okay. Oh. I just thought this was a good idea when
we... Name in the record. I'm sorry. Just give us your name first.
Oh, my name is Gwen Luda, and I live at 3550 Southwest Bond Avenue, where the tram is.
Oh, yeah.
That's the general area. And we were a beehive of activity in our building yesterday. I live at Mirabella. And there had been a stop sign put out front so that we could cross safely. It was put on Bond going north. And we would cross at Curry to get to the made up, you know, the construction, Hoffman Construction has put open 2 sides here. And this really, I suppose, is for Peabot. This is why I came here, because I saw it in the paper that you were having a hearing. So I just wanted to let you, Peabot know, and to you to know that we really would like to have a stop sign put back up there. Somebody put it up, took it down, and now our residents and all, we have charter schools, we have Montessori schools, and we have over 300 senior citizens trying to get back and forth across this street. and we just wanted to bring it to your attention that Hoffman Construction and OHSU or whoever needs to put the sign back up. Why was it put up and taken down? And we would like to have it back up to have safe crossing. And I guess basically that's our concern.
Ms. Leda, just wanted to say thank you. We actually are looking at that because others at Mirabella have raised this issue. And normally, whether we put a stop sign up depends on certain traffic count data. So we're taking another look at the traffic count. But also, there's some special factors of that location that I think might argue for putting the sign up, even if it doesn't fit quite within our normal traffic count guidelines. So we are looking at that this week. So thank you very much.
Well, thank you very much. I just thought it was a good opportunity.
You say you live in the Mirabella?
Yes.
So just by chance, I was at a reception yesterday, and Congressman Blumenauer mentioned he spoke at the Mirabella yesterday.
I was there.
He said he was greeted at the door by former Secretary of State Norma Paulus.
She is a resident.
And he said that the host committee, he thought, resembled the City Club Executive Committee of about 1975 or 1980. He said it was an honor to be with so many city leaders.
Great. Right. We're proud to have Norma. Right.
Yeah, that's great. Thank you very much.
Thank you.
Johnson, I think you're next.
Ms. Tseng, would you like to go first?
Yeah. All right. I'm glad that this issue, for the record, my name is Charles Johnson, and it's quite fortuitous that we opened up with public comment. I noticed that the speaker for item number 736, Ms. Camilla Rose Waters is still here and specifically talked about, and this presentation also talked about Belmont. And I wish they'd gone a little bit further down the street because this has actually been implemented only a few blocks away from the Aging and Disability Services office, the Jersey barriers. It's the first time in Portland I've ever seen sane, humane consideration given to pedestrians, except for one thing I just remembered. Across from the Peace Shelter, where there's no active heavy-duty construction, we have New York-style sidewalks with overhead protection. And I think it's going to be some difficult work for Mr. Novick and the Bureau of Transportation on their current budget as things boom to really be assertive with construction contractors about what their real needs are. I think they've, in the past, been spoiled with like, oh, you want to limit your construction budget now and it's all good for you to inconvenience every other Portlander because someday we'll collect increased property taxes on your building. I think that the fee structure, obviously I'm no high salaried expert, but I think that the fee structure and costs that are in aren't really addressed that much in the 5-page PDF that comes with this item. And they won't be unless more citizens engage with you and assertively agitate that these issues are things that people have had a hard time communicating about and that really we hope for improvement to see some of the things that have happened. Ms. Raisman mentioned when you were at the, if you went to the people going to the library at the corner of Salmon and 10th, I don't know how it happened with the planning of the upgrade for the sidewalk rampage, but it was kind of disastrous because what happens, it's not so bad for me. I meant to talk about privilege when I walked up here. It's very easy for me to backtrack a half block or a whole block. It's gross that somebody in a wheelchair or with a vision impairment would proceed a whole block, get to a place where there's no audible clues, as Ms. Fritz pointed out. We can simply improve the city code so that contractors have to put audible announcers at intersections. We give them the pass of saying they don't have to, probably because they're supposed to have it effectively physically blocked so a blind person would encounter an obstruction, but that never happens. You go a half block, you get to a place where people are able-bodied people cross the street, and other people will take risks. And so I hope we can get some progress on this. Thanks for letting me go over 20 seconds.
I appreciate it. No, there's some questions there that I'm going to want staff to respond to, so I appreciate you raising those. So thank you. Okay, Ms. Zane, go ahead, please.
Good
Hello, Steve Novick, Commissioner, Amanda Fritz, Commissioner, Charlie Hales, Mayor, Dan Saltzman, Commissioner, and Nick Fish, Commissioner, President of the Council. I want to thank you so much for bringing forward Measure 737 regarding accommodation of pedestrians and bicyclists in and around work zones. As you do recall, the Portland police brutality victim who suffered left eye blindness and whose left eye was ground across the ground by Officer Clunt and Officer Sioeta was a dear, dear, close friend of mine whom I helped on many occasions over the years. And one of the problems we had with that left eye blindness is that it occurred on a person who was 6'3" of stature. And that tree overhang can often be an issue, as well as awnings, which might jut down and protrude into the seeing eye, which the seeing eye was nearly lost in the police brutality, as you do recall, when it was nearly gouged into the chair, which this unfortunate traumatic brain injury victim who had been suffered but was rescued by the good work of the Coast Guard was very grateful to find out about the Americans with Disabilities Act, and I'm very thrilled that we're working on international disabilities acts and hope that we can continue to be a model internationally. Unfortunately, not much money or vision gets across the Rocky Mountains, and so we're not quite where we need to be. We know that. We know that these disabled people are suffering, blind people are suffering. We know that people in wheelchairs are suffering, indeed sometimes even getting hit. And so, with that in mind, I request that you take this Portland Bureau of Transportation to adopt administrative rules for the safe accommodation of pedestrians and bicyclists in and around work zones very, 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 very seriously, because this is truly a matter of life and death. And while you cannot curtail the police brutality against disabled persons, clearly you could curtail the egregious abuse of the Americans with Disabilities Act in this Cascadia region, which is hanging on by a thread to the United States of America, or the so-called United States of America. And whether your political opinion is for secession or for union, I do request that you put the greater interest of those disabled persons at heart and know how tremendously brave they are every time they walk out of the house, so confident to go about their business and have an enjoyable time, possibly even at your council, possibly at a library, doing something that they love, and celebrate all the resources, such as Independent Living Resources, an excellent nonprofit who did indeed assist my friend with issues surrounding brain injury and visual impairment. And thank you very much. It's lovely to see you all again. Mary Ang, that is.
Yeah, thank you very much. Okay, let's take the next folks, please.
Next three are David Davis, Reza Farhudi, and Rob Sadowski.
Okay, come on up. Good morning.
So my name is David Keith Davis with Multnomah County Cop Watch. I wanted to say that, you know, you guys emphasize safety on the roadways and bike stuff, but it doesn't seem like you really care too much about child sex trafficking.
We need to stay on this subject, Mr. Davis. I'm going to warn you once
about
that.
I'm bringing it back. I'm allowed to talk about various things.
No, you're allowed to talk about this thing.
Yes, I am. I'm allowed to bring up topics and then talk about PBOT and all this other stuff.
Yes,
and
talk
you
about
can't
PBOT, please.
Cut me off. So let's start my testimony over again at 3 minutes.
Sure, and stay on topic, please.
Okay, so here we go again. So you guys emphasize all this stuff about bike safety and traffic safety, but do you really care about safety about child sex trafficking?
Davis, I'm going to rule you out of order.
Do you care
We're
about
recessed.
Joe Wallace.
We're recessed. Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis. Mr. Davis, the chamber, please.